Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, search planes spot objects in the new search area for the missing Malaysia airliner. Vietnamese turn to the internet to find safe vegetables. And an American reflects on his childhood in China. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. Australian search planes have spotted objects in the Indian Ocean in the area where the search for the missing Malaysian airliner has shifted. The Australian Maritime Safety Authority said an Orion surveillance aircraft spotted the objects today in the new search location, about 1,850 kilometres west of the Australian city of Perth. In a statement on Twitter, the AMSA said the plane is in the process of sending back images of the objects, which will need to be confirmed. It said ships will not be able to reach the area until Saturday. Earlier today, the search was shifted more than 1,000 kilometers northeast after investigators determined the missing jetliner was traveling faster and expanding fuel quicker than previously estimated, reducing the distance it flew. AMSA General Manager John Young said today the information based on radar data is the most credible lead so far in the search for the wreckage, but warned there is a long way to go yet.
This is the normal business of search and rescue operations, that new information comes to light, refined analyses take you to a different place. I don't count the original work a waste of time.
Malaysian Defence Minister Hishamuddin Hussein said given ocean drift, the new location could still be consistent with possible debris spotted in satellite photos over the past week near the old search location. Hishamuddin also said Malaysia has received fresh satellite images from Thai and Japanese authorities showing more possible objects in the old search location. He did not specify when the photos were taken. The extremely remote search location and bad weather at sea have kept authorities from reaching the possible debris from the Malaysian airliner, which disappeared March 8th with 239 people on board. This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, Burma conducts a census. Vietnam, there are rising concerns about the excessive use of pesticides on crops. To ensure their vegetables are safe, some consumers are now shopping for produce online. Marianne Brown reports from Hanoi.
Billboards carry the message, "Don't abuse pesticides, think of the consumer." But a lack of government regulation has done little to combat the overuse of pesticides, and consumers are taking note. As a result, many are turning to the internet to be better informed. Out shopping in Hanoi city centre, 30-year-old mother Chun Thuy Nhat expresses concerns many people here can identify with. She says she only buys vegetables from people she knows in her village on the outskirts of the city. She is worried about chemicals in vegetables and fruit and says if she buys these from someone she doesn't know, they could be harmful to her baby. Not everyone is lucky enough to have access to farmers they know well. But a website dedicated to providing information about shops which sell safe vegetables in Hanoi aims to address this lack of trust. The site Zo Sak Ngui Tiêu Zum, which means safe vegetables consumers, was set up by Vietnam's consumer association Vinastas in 2011. Dan Kiem Hien is part of the team in charge of it.
Vinastas tập trung vào vấn đề tuyên truyền cho người tiêu dùng.
She said the website gives addresses and phone numbers of shops selling safe or organic vegetables. Shops have to provide detailed information such as invoices, addresses and telephone numbers to prove that they get the vegetables from sources which are deemed safe or organic. If a shop is discovered to not be applying, it will be expelled, Hien says. Farmers in Vietnam use a lot of pesticides. In its effort to push productivity and food security goals, the government promotes use of chemical inputs such as fertilizer and pesticides and subsidizes them. Eduardo Sabio is Hanoi-based regional representative of Belgian non-governmental organization Vico, which supported the ZOSAC website. And he says there is a real problem with pesticide misuse.
Some are actually improperly labeled because they come from suspect origin. The government, they have a list of pesticides that are, I would say, allowed. But almost always there are, like, in quotation, illegal pesticides that gets into the border and sold to the farmers.
Because of Vietnam's agrarian system, which allows farmers to have access to very small parcels of land, it is very difficult for growers to produce organic vegetables, he says.
So in, say, for example, in a half-hectare area, there could be easily four or five or even more farmers planting different crops at different times of the year using different pesticides and chemicals. So even if you claim to be organic in a 1,000 square meter of farm, but your neighbor is using pesticides sometimes restricted without any barrier between the two farms, you cannot claim that you are organic because the drift from applications of pesticides and residues can easily spill over to your farms.
He says Vietnam does have an organic certification process, but it is not suited to smallholders because of the large number of criteria, forms to fill in, and the high cost. That's why ZOSAC uses the Participatory Guidance System, PGS, which is applied in more than 20 other countries around the world. The system tries to enforce quality standards via regular peer review that involves a wide range of stakeholders, including farmers' associations, traders, and local officials. Farmers keep detailed logbooks of each pesticide spray, which is regularly monitored. Nearby farmers also keep an eye on what applications are being made by their neighbours. Ha Mi, who runs the Hanoi branch of Vuon Zo, an online vegetable delivery service, says her business is certified with Vietgap. After setting up just last year, they already have around 1,000 customers around the country. Ha says consumers are worried about the origin of their vegetables, so more people are turning to online resources like Facebook.
The Facebook is it's also the real life of people. So from friend by friend, that they know the mutual friend, have mutual friend. Oh, my friend buy from this shop, and she saw the delicious vegetable. Then I trust my friend. So now I trust your shop. And it's also the name and the face of people too, who use the Facebook too. Like the more friends you got, or the who you are. It shows on your Facebook too.
Trust is key. For that reason, experts say Vietnam needs a regulatory body to ensure producers comply with the requirements for organic or safe farming. This is not just for the benefit of farmers and consumers, but also to avoid cases of poisoning linked to government-subsidized pesticides. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
Burma is conducting its first census in more than three decades at a time when ethnic and religious tensions are high. Census workers are expected to record each person's race and religion, which pose problems for ethnic Rohingya Muslims who are not recognized as Burmese citizens. Gabrielle Paluk reports from Yangon.
Burma's government does not officially recognize some ethnic groups that have long lived within its borders. But the upcoming census requires they be counted under one of the country's officially recognized ethnicities. Stateless ethnic Rohingya Muslims, most of whom are living in conflict-stricken Rakhine State, are among those who will have to identify as other and write in their ethnicity. Population Minister Kin Yi suggests that those who write in Rohingya could face prosecution for providing misinformation. He refers to the Rohingya as Bengali, reflecting government policy that considers them foreigners from Bangladesh. He does not expect problems in Sitwe, the capital of Rakhine.
We did not do a test census in Sitwe in Rakhine State because at the time there was a conflict between the two communities. We have since discussed the two communities, Rakhine and Bengali, and they accept the census process. Because the census process is all-inclusive, those who don't participate will lose their chance.
Observers worry that the ethnic and religious identification questions could worsen ostracism of some communities. But UN technical advisors say it's too late and too expensive to change the questionnaire. In the lead-up to the census, the extremist anti-Muslim monk Wiratu has delivered well-attended speeches in Rakhine State about protecting race and religion and has led protests advocating a census boycott. Here, Wiratu is accusing Muslims of targeting monks and terrorizing good people. He says authorities should kick out international aid groups that help Muslims. He also says Muslims should be denied citizenship and marriage rights. Za A is a minister for Rakhine Nationalities Affairs who is concerned about ongoing violence in his hometown. He says the situation will improve if people stop identifying themselves as Rohingya.
Putting the name of a people that don't exist will cause violence. But if they're counted as Bengalis, there won't be any problems.
Jamin is a Rohingya politician who says many fear identifying as Rohingya will threaten their legal status, but not identifying as Rohingya will leave their community underrepresented.
I am Rohingya. I will enlist as Rohingya. I think the enumerators will also write me as Rohingya, because they have the duty according to census law. Claiming an ethnicity is not the question of violence. Who will initiate the violence? It is the question.
Burma's nationwide census begins at the end of this month. This is Gabrielle Pollock reporting for VOA News from Rangoon.
South Africa's education minister says the nation of 11 official languages will introduce Mandarin into its school curriculum. The move is part of a greater effort to get closer to major trading partner China and has been criticized and welcomed. VOA's Anita Powell asks if this nation of linguists is ready for Chinese.
If you want to say hello in South Africa, you have no shortage of options in this nation of 11 official languages. It's Sawubona in Zulu, Hello in Afrikaans, and Dumelang in Setswana. And of course, there is always Hello. But now South Africa's education ministry hopes to add another language to this polyglot nation by saying Ni Hao to Mandarin Chinese. An agreement this month between the two nations focuses on five areas of cooperation: curriculum development, math and science, teacher training, vocational education, and research and development in basic education. Ministry of Basic Education spokeswoman Troy Martens says the new partnership is extremely valuable to both countries, though officials have not said how much the initiative will cost.
It's very exciting because it takes the relationship between South Africa and China beyond just trade relations and into issues of mutual development for both of our developing countries. So it's very exciting, and both countries have indicated that for them education is a high priority, and that's why education is high on the agenda of collaboration between the two countries.
The aspect of the plan that has garnered the most attention is a plan to roll out Mandarin language in South African schools. South Africans have mixed feelings about China, according to a Pew study last year that showed that 46% of South Africans said they did not like the spread of Chinese ideas and customs in their country. And 60% of South Africans say they dislike Chinese music, movies, and television. But Martin said the market trumps those feelings.
China is South Africa's biggest trading partner, so it is extremely beneficial for learners in South Africa to be exposed to the Mandarin language as well as Chinese culture. Now, this won't be compulsory, it won't be for every school, and it won't be for every child, but for schools that feel they have the capacity to offer Mandarin as a subject, we think it's a great opportunity for South African learners to be exposed to, this international type of language.
South Africa's census does not say how many native Chinese speakers there are in this country of nearly 51 million people. that they are likely somewhere within the 830,000 South Africans who told census takers their first language was not among the 12 most popular. Principal Lisette Noonan heads the Pretoria Chinese School, a kindergarten to grade 12 private school of about 500 students in the capital, Pretoria. Every student studies Mandarin. Noonan says the school, which has been around for 80 years, welcomes the new collaboration between the two nations.
We were quite excited by the announcement. We do believe that it is in the best interest of our children to know the Mandarin, especially with China becoming such a huge economic power in the world.
South African schools suffer from the legacy of apartheid, which just two decades ago intentionally gave inferior education to the majority of the population. China has in that time drastically expanded its education system, and last year the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development ranked students in Shanghai as the world's top scorers in reading, science, and mathematics. South Africa hopes the alliance will not only better South African students, but also bring them some of China's success. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. James Gillespie had a unique upbringing. The son of Christian missionaries, he was born in Beijing in 1931 and spent much of his childhood in China. During World War II, the family returned to the United States but traveled back to China after the war. Gillespie returned to the U.S. and went on to become a college biology professor. He's now retired and lives in Maryland, near Washington, D.C. His youth and upbringing are described in his book Around the World and Headed South, growing up as a twin and a missionary kid. I spoke with him about some of his childhood, first in Kaifeng and later in Shanghai under the Japanese occupation.
Well, we lived in Kaifeng, which was the capital of Henan province. And Kaifeng was at the end of the first millennium, I think the largest city in the world, or second largest city in the world. That's kind of hard to imagine, but it was a big city, and it had a big wall around it. And we lived on the outside of that wall, so we did not live in the enclosed part of the city.
What was it like for you? You know, you were a family of Americans, and I know your father was a missionary. Well, I think both your parents were missionaries. But do you remember that perhaps some of the Chinese might have given you curious looks because you weren't Chinese? I mean, in those days, China was much more isolated than it is today.
Everywhere we went, we were Chinese children come running after the rickshaws and point to us. Yang Guizhe, which meant foreign devil. And I remember one time later on when we were in Shanghai, one man walking along the street, we were parked along the street, one man walking by looked in the car window and said, Yang Guizhe. My dad asked the man, the foreign devil, is the foreign devil is better than the Chinese devil? And the man said, they're the same. We were called foreign devils. I don't know why. I don't think it was a derogatory thing. It was just pointed out that way. Also, we had blue eyes, and white skin and the blue eyes really made us stand out as being different.
The Shanghai that you remember as a child, what was it like?
Well, most of what I remember was after the World War II was over with. I had been through Shanghai the first time we went to the States, but we went to school and lived in the city of Shanghai after World War II. It was a bustling city, and streets were absolutely filled with people. When two cars came along the street and tried to pass each other, coming toward each other, we would blow our horns. In fact, we could wear out our horns in the car just by blowing them all the time. People would move over just enough to let one car go by and not the other. So it was very, very crowded, a metropolis of a city. Very, very interesting. And in many respects.
Now, you also write in your book about as World War II was beginning to get underway, and I should also say the Americans, we should say it was getting to the point where I think your family realized that, you know, the United States was going to be getting involved in the war. And I believe that you spoke a bit about, I think you were actually in Shanghai, but you or your family were trying to flee China.
First, I remember about the conflict was before we went to the States in the first place. There were riots, and the Chinese were rioting against each other. And I think this was now thought of as being the beginning of the communist movement. The Chinese very often would raid the foreigners and kill them. I remember one night my dad stayed at the bottom of the steps with a baseball bat to protect the rest of the family, which was kept upstairs. Now, that was the beginning of the communist insurgence into China. That stopped, of course, when the war broke out. But we were in China in 1939 to 1940, and the Japanese occupied that part of China.
At that time, as the war was sort of approaching, I know you and your family were getting ready to leave, although I think your father stayed on for a while.
Yes, he
but,
did.
You know, did you sense in the city among Chinese people the concerns that they had about the war?
I didn't personally sense that. I do know that the Japanese official that was in charge of visiting us and taking care of our business, they were very, very careful not to get in trouble with us. In fact, when our parents went back to China in 1939, we went back with the promise that we would not, the U.S. government would not defend us because they didn't want to get into war with Japan, and Japan didn't want to get into war with us at that time either. But the Japanese official would come and visit our home, and we kids were very, very frightened about him. He'd come dressed in a full military uniform with a big sword. He had a reputation of killing people with a sword. I don't know whether it was true or not, but I remember one time I was running down the hall with a cap gun in my hand and bumped into this man. It scared me to death.
Well, you were born in China, and you've been there a number of times. But recently, somewhat recently, as an adult, I believe you and your brother went back. What was that like, going back so many years later?
Well, it was wonderful. It was absolutely thrilling to me. It was very interesting to see how China had progressed since we had been there in 1948. China had grown. It had an interstate highway system that they were very proud of. The main street that we stayed in when we visited Beijing was modern. It looked like something you might find in New York City.
That is James Gillespie, the author of the book Around the World and Headed South, growing up as a twin and a missionary kid. And it's all about his childhood in China. Well, there are a number of reminiscences about people who spent time in China many years ago, usually as part of missionary families. And it's always very interesting to read what they have to say and also reflect on how much China has changed over the decades. Well, thanks very much for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yaki coming up next.